Blog Talk Radio.
Good afternoon, brothers and sisters. This is Brother George, and Brother Marvin is not with us today, so myself and Sister Jackie is going to do our best to fill in for him. Today, you know, welcome to Empowerment Saturday. Today, we're going to continue the lecture with Dr. Bruce Bridges on recapturing the African mind, and we'll have question and answers at the end. And so, you know, get yourself prepared to ask your question or make your comment and try to make it no longer than 30 seconds to a minute because we want, you know, to involve other people that's on the line. Is Dr. Bridges, are you on the line, brother? Dr. Bridges.
Hey, Brother George. I'm looking for his number, and I don't quite see it.
Okay, 5972, you don't see that?
I do not see 5972 quite yet.
Okay, well, what we'll do, he'll eventually get on the line. So I guess you and I can have a conversation about how's things been going with your Black History Month? Did you go involve yourself with anything?
Actually, it was a little quiet this year. We didn't have as many Black History Month events this year, and I think it's because of COVID and people are still a little more hesitant to do anything right now. But one thing I did notice is that we have more companies that are trying to be more mindful of representing the Black community, but you know, it could get better. I will say that.
Right.
I agree. I do think I see Dr. Bridges on the line now. I'm going to unmute him. Dr.
Okay.
Bridges, are you there?
I am.
Okay.
All right, Brother George, I'm going to turn it back over to you.
Okay, thank you. Dr. Bridges is on the line now, and so we can get his segment started. And I would like to start by asking Dr. Bridges, what have you been doing for Black History Month? Have you had many speaking engagements or anything to that effect?
Yeah, as a matter of fact, Brother George, and thank you for the announcement, too, about Black History Month. It is a time of the year that we get a chance to celebrate our Blackness in this society. But, of course, we here on African-American Empowerment believe that 365, one-fourth days of the year is Black History Month. So we just continue what we where we left off and keep it going, because and I really mean seriously, because the more we study and the more we learn, we see that it's crazy to try to even do it in one week. And to think about how when Dr. Woodson established it in 1926, it was only one day. So, you know, it's just it's really an insult. It's really an insult, because you cannot discuss anything in the history of the world without uncovering some of the contributions, some of the monument building, some of the science, technology, engineering, mathematics. You can't discuss any arts and literature or anything really, music, drama, we know, without discussing black people. So it is definitely, it's really an insult to even to talk about a Black History Month, you know. And I say that because the more we begin to know, then that's what you really come to. You just, you know. So that's it. So it. But to answer your question, I did a couple of church dates this year for Black History Month. I spoke at a good friend of mine's church in Apex, North Carolina, Dr. Lafayette Maxwell, and spoke there at his church, and then also did couple of podcasts, and then I did a university out in a town in Washington State near Seattle, not in Seattle, but near Seattle, a school called Centralia University, and I did two lectures on a Zoom call, and hopefully I'll be going out there again sometime soon. So those were some of the things that I did, you know, during Black History Month. And I'm glad to hear Sister mention corporations. Now, not this year, but last year I did a lecture on the African contributions to I was supposed to do it this year, but we didn't do it. But last year I did a lecture at a corporation, an internationally known corporation called Biogen, on Black history. I did it on the Black History of Durham, North Carolina. And so when she mentioned corporations are starting to do it, she's absolutely right about that. And that's why wherever we are as people, whatever job we're doing, whatever work we're doing, whatever it might be, if we work for city government, if we work for a corporation, if we work at a university, a daycare center, whatever it is, whatever it is, in somebody's office, whatever we're doing in a plant, a plantation, a plant, a security guard, whatever we're doing as a people, we should really, really try to push our history on that particular job. And the reason I spoke at Biogen Corporation, because there's a sister who works there who's conscious of black history. She brought it up to the company officials and said, hey, we talk about these other events going on throughout the year that we celebrate. She said, well, this is my month. Black History Month is my month coming up. She mentioned it in January. So Biogen had me for Black History Month. So wherever we are, we as people have to push forward for our history. So that made me think about that. So that's another place that I've spoken to.
Dr. Bridges, I want to take a break in your and I's action temporarily to allow Sister Jackie to do some of the intro that Marvin normally would do. And so I'd like to bring her back.
Okay, and then we can go back to New York City.
We're going to go back to the question on Black History Month when she finishes.
All right.
Okay. Sister Jackie.
Yes, I'm back. Thank you. So we're getting a little bit
You're
off.
Welcome.
I forgot to provide this information in the beginning. So, Marvin, please forgive me, but we're trying to hold it down on your behalf. So I just wanted to give the mission of the NAAEA. So the mission of the National African American Empowerment Association is to ensure that the needs of the African American community are met through the development of programs and services that support, inspire, motivate, and empower each member. We will collaborate and partner with existing community-based organizations, specifically HBCUs, to promote the concept of peace within the community in the areas of politics, economics, athletics, meaning health, wellness, fitness, and nutrition, culture, and education. And those, the politics, economics, athletics, culture, and education make up the peace concept that NAAEA promotes. We will resurrect, promote, develop, and instill a sense of pride, integrity, dignity, respect, and love for self and for one another within the community. So on the topic of Black History Month, I mean, the NAAEA supports that all year round. We don't just leave it up to February to do those things in our community. And I will also add that if you want to invite anyone to the show, our number is 845-277-9250. Again, that's 845-277-9250. And I'll turn it back over to Brother George and Dr. Bridges. Thank you.
Well, thank you very much, Sister Jackie, for that intro. I'm hoping that we're doing a satisfactory job with the absence of the master, Brother Marvin, not here today. However, I want to get back to Dr. Bridges. Dr. Bridges, over the years, I've heard this name, you know, connected with a lot of our scholars. And I wanted to know if you knew anything about him and his background, you know, just any kind of information on Dr. Arthur Schomburg.
Yes, as a matter of fact, Brother George, I'm glad you asked me that question, because in my lecture out in Centralia University out in Washington, state of Washington, out on the West Coast via Zoom, I mentioned Dr. Schomburg in my second lecture that I did out there, and he's a good way for us to start off today and to continue our Black history, because he and Dr. Carter G. Woodson, the founder of Black history, were somewhat similar, very much similar, as a matter of fact, in that they both tried to, not tried, but they emphasized the importance of Black history and Black culture. And so, yeah, I did talk about Dr. Schomburg, and Dr. Schomburg, Arturo, A-R-T-U-R-O, Schomburg, S-C-H-O-M-B-U-R-G, and I'm doing this, Brother George, because a lot of times our people are taking notes, so I'm just taking my time. But Arturo Schomburg was his name, A-R-T-U-R-O, Schomburg, S-C-H-O-M-B-U-R-G, and his middle name was Alfonso. Spanish name, he was from Puerto Rico, but a Black man from Puerto Rico, because everywhere that colonizers have gone in this earth, they've always colonized the people of color who were indigenous to those particular lands and territories, or who they brought there as slaves. So, of course, there are Black people in Puerto Rico, just like there are Black people in North Island, South Carolina, Virginia, you see. So Dr. Arturo Alfonso Schomburg was born January 24th, 1874, on the island of Puerto Rico in the town of Santurce. Santurce is where he was born. And Dr. Schomburg was, his mother was actually from the Virgin Islands, from the U.S. Virgin Islands they are today. But during that time, of course, they were the Virgin Islands, but it's where she's from. I can't think of the town. But anyway, his mother was a Black woman. And Dr. Schomburg got started in his search for Black history when, as the story goes, he went to school and wanted to do a report. And having Spanish teachers, and of course Spanish European teachers, told him that Black people had no had made no contributions to history. He wanted to report on a black person. But he said, the teacher told him, say, your people have no history. There's nothing for you to report on. Isn't that something? Your people have no history, and there's nothing for you to report on. So Dr. Schomburg, Arturo Alfonso Schomburg, never forgot that. And in about 17 years of age, in about 1891, Schomburg came to the United States. And when he came to the United States from Puerto Rico, during that time, of course, he was a historian, he was a writer, researcher, but he got a job in New York City as a bellhop, as a printer, and also operated an elevator, you see, because those are the menial labor kinds of jobs that black people were forced into during that time. But all the while Schomburg was doing this, he was collecting whatever he possibly could on the history and heritage of black people. And he was very active in black organizations during the time, NAACP, other black organizations in New York at the time. And Dr. Schomburg, as he was compiling all this information now, which is a good point, and I'm glad, like I said, I'm glad you asked that question, because when I was discussing the Harlem Renaissance on Washington State a few weeks ago for Black History Month, in doing my research, I found that there were certain forces behind the surge of creativity in the arts and the humanities during the Harlem Renaissance. There were certain forces that that was behind this push for creativity in the arts and the sciences. And you notice that everything that was going on in the Harlem Renaissance was preoccupied with race. It was about race, and of course, black people knew about the race. I mean, the race war in East St. Louis in 1917, and when the black soldiers were over fighting a war, white people started a race riot in 1917. Black people in Harlem and all over the world also were quite conscious of the lynchings that were going on in the South. And of course, Billie Holiday did her song Strange Fruit, as she talked about the strange fruit that was hanging from the trees, meaning the lynchings, you see. So all these were the kinds of forces that were pushing black people to become very creative. But one thing that was known in the Harlem Renaissance by the writers, by the poets, novelists, and also by the jazz entertainers and the dancers and singers and everything, other sculptors and other things that were going on in the Harlem Renaissance. One thing that you were required to do during that time is to go to the Schomburg Library on 135th Street and read some of the works that were in that particular library. They were, and this is why the writings and the sculpturing that was done, the poems that were written, the songs that were sang, they had to do with black culture and black awareness, and had to do with race, because many of those people were going to the library. They were reading the books that Schomburg had there. And this is why libraries and books are very important to any people. This is before computers now. But nowadays, you can get just about everything you want on a computer, but not everything, not saying that. But you have to have access to information. So with access to information going into the minds or into the heads of these black people, that their poems began to reflect what they were reading. Whenever you see any human being, what they have inside their heads is going to be reflected when they begin to speak, when they begin to dance, when they begin to sing, when they begin to make comments, when they write poetry, when they draw, when they're painters. It's going to come out. What's inside of you is going to come out. And so, due to the access of the information there during the Harlem Renaissance, with Arturo Schomburg had collected and compiled there, Alain Locke He wrote his poem called what? The New Negro. This is a new Negro here. This ain't the same old Negro y'all been knowing all the time now. It's a new Negro on the scene. I want y'all to understand that. And so Alain Locke wrote The New Negro. Also, you had people like County Cullen, who wrote his What is Africa to Me? What is Africa to Me? He's talking about Africa. It's because he was reading about Africa. Africa was all around him at the time. Black people in Harlem during the time. In the early 20s, there was about 200,000 black people in Harlem, and the library was there. Again, access to information. And then you have, of course, Langston Hughes. I've known Rivers. I've known Rivers, you see, talking about the Tigris and the Euphrates, talking about the Nile River, you see. So it's because what Schomburg did was an inspiration, for the participants in the Harlem Renaissance. Now, a very good point that I really want to make about this as we get off Schomburg for a minute. Eventually, Schomburg, he sold his books to the New York Public Library, and at that time he had about 3,000 manuscripts and about 5,000 books. 3,000 manuscripts and about 5,000 books, and it was sold for $10,000 at the time. That's what he sold it for. And they put Schomburg over the collection, but that particular library was bought with a grant from the Carnegie Foundation. Now, I don't have time to go into it today, and this is not, it's another subject, but when you look at the Carnegie Foundation and you begin to study the architects of black education in the United States, and that's what happened when I say architects, black education in the United States was defined. I mean, designed, pardon me, were defined too, was designed and defined by architects who created it, and who constructed it with money that was put into academic programs at black schools. And what they wanted to do, and I'm finding this out too from other sources that I've been reading lately, and that is with that grant, they wanted to take that library and put it into a private collection. Now, what does this do if you put a library into a private in a private collection? That means that only certain people are going to have access to that information. Listen very carefully, and I hope we have some listeners, and I hope we got quite a few people that are listening on the telephone and listening on the computer. Call some people, tell them to tune in. But when you restrict your readership, when you restrict your populace of people, I mean, your people who are going to read or have access to your information, that means only a certain group or set or you know, unique set of people are going to have access to the information. And what you will find, brothers and sisters, and to those who are tuned in today to the African American Empowerment Program here with Brother Marvin and Brother George, you will find that this is what has happened to a lot of our history. Rich white people, for the most part, have bought these libraries, bought these collections, have bought the statues, bought the paintings, the manuscripts, the books, and have taken them out of the public domain, and so people don't have access to them. And this is why, as I said before, when we studied the as we study history tonight, right now, as I'm beginning to study from a brand new perspective, and that is a lot of the information that we've been given is half truth. So a lot that's been omitted, been taken away from us, that's hidden in vaults in the Vatican, in Italy, hidden in private collections by wealthy people, by the elite and those in positions of power who want to keep this whole idea of white supremacy moving in the world. And that's another lecture too, but maybe we'll get to that at some point. But this is what they tried to do to the Schomburg collection. I haven't forgotten my point, but Arturo Schomburg said, no, I want the library to be public, and that's why it is a public library today. But with the money from white folk, the Carnegie Foundation, they want to take it and make it a private collection, and that is so that you and I, brothers and sisters, who are tuned into the African American Empowerment Program, would not have access to that information. So I just really want to make that point here today on the program, Brother George. That's why I'm glad you asked that question. And because of Schomburg, we have a Harlem Renaissance, and Garvey was around during that time too. And we also had so you see, when black people began to push forward and to get out into the world and begin to study and learn in this country with the Harlem Renaissance, there were black people down in the French-speaking islands and the French-speaking world where black people had been colonized by the French in islands like Guadeloupe and in places like Haiti, in places like Martinique. You see, in French-speaking islands, there was something that emerged called negritude, the negritude movement. And the negritude movement was kind of, it kind of sat juxtaposed or right next to the Harlem Renaissance, because as the Harlem Renaissance was beginning to kind of decline, the French-speaking Caribbean black folk began to step forward. People like Leon Demas, I think, from Martinique, yeah, and Aimé Césaire from Guadeloupe, two French-speaking islands, and Leopold Senghor from Senegal, West Africa, another French-speaking part of the world. So they began, they were students in Paris at the time, and they have a newspaper called Les Etudiants, which means Les Etudiants Noirs, the black student. And I'm not, you know, if my French, those people tuned in, yeah, my French is terrible, but that's the colonizer language, and I'm not too good at. But anyway, they started a newspaper, and they started doing the same thing that was happening with the Harlem Renaissance, but doing it from a French perspective, and that's why we have a France Fanon, the France Fanon, Black Skin, White Mask, who wrote the books on colonialism, you see. And so when black people began to wake up and exert themselves and push forward after being inspired by their culture and their heritage, then we're on the move. And see, Schomburg in his collection even today is one of the best in the world, if not the best. I saw Elijah Muhammad's grandson was the director of that Schomburg collection at one time, and by the way, he looks just like Elijah Muhammad too, Khalil Gibran Muhammad. He was the director of the Schomburg collection, but he's now at Harvard University. So that's just so you have to those who are tuned in and who are learning in our classroom today. Call some people having to tune in. You know about the Harlem Renaissance, and then you know about the French-speaking counterpart of the Harlem Renaissance, which was the Negritude movement. And Schomburg had letters in his collection that had been written from Haiti, and he talked about Beethoven being of African descent. He knew and had that information. And Michelangelo, I don't know whether he had Michelangelo or not, but that's something I just found out, the great sculptor and artist of his time. We say Michelangelo, however you want to pronounce it. And there's a picture of him hanging in the National Gallery in London, which has been whitened, has had chemicals put on it, and has been whitened, and it's dated 1518 to 1520. But that photograph of Michelangelo hanging in the London National Gallery, according to an expert by the name of Charles Hope, the leading expert on that particular photograph, he believes that's a picture that was done in the 1950s. Rather than in the era of 1518 to 1520, that was a picture done in the 1950s. And there's a book, a magazine, a British magazine called Look and Learn, and in issue number 1004, which came out in 1981, it describes Michelangelo, the greatest artist and sculptor of his time, and describes him as being short, swarthy, Swarthy, S-W-A-R-T-H-Y, Swarthy, which means black, Swartz in German, and Suret in French. But it says he's short, swarthy, with a broken nose, big peasant hands, and a disproportionately large head topped by a tangle of dark, unwashed hair. You see, a short, swarthy man. You see, but you see, they have taken this away from us, and this is not our topic today, but this is Black History Month, and I know people say, okay, February is Black History Month. No, we're still black. It's March, but we haven't turned quite yet. We're still black. Okay. But anyway, Michelangelo. And so these are some of the kinds of things that Arturo Alfonso Schomburg was compiling, things about like with the letters from Alexander Dumas, who was invited to come to the United States in the 1800s by the president at that time. But Dumas, in his letter back to the president of the United States, he said, no, I have to refuse your invitation to come to your country because I'm a black man, and I believe that if I come to your country, I'll be put into slavery like the rest of my people. So I have to turn down your invitation, Mr. President. Alexander Dumas, who wrote The Count of Monte Cristo, The Three Musketeers, and who was a black man. And there are stories told about him and how he jumped on the stage when Ira Aldridge, the great black singer, appeared in France. As the story goes, Dumas, who was a short, stocky man with thick, woolly afro, he jumped up on the stage and told Ira Aldridge, I'm proud of you, and I, too, am a Negro. So these people knew what they were. But when we were growing up and hearing these stories, and when I remember being as a little boy buying the Three Musketeers candy bar and looking at the Three Musketeers on Walt Disneyland with their sword and their fencing techniques, I had no idea that that was something that had come out of the head of a black Frenchman named Alexander Dumas.
Brother, you're going to make the audience get mad at me because I got to cut you because I want you to get into your lecture for today.
Okay, you know, but you asked me the question, brother.
We're going to have... yes, sir. Yeah. But we...
At least I hope they were learning. I hope that they've been inspired to do more learning. And one thing I like to always say about whatever you hear come out of my mouth, check it out. Don't take my word for it. Go behind me and look it up, because I don't make up things when I'm speaking and teaching on the history of our people. I want to have the research in place. And just one final statement, Brother George, before I go back to you and get started on the book, and that is that there is so much of our history that's been uncovered, and many of our historians, I don't care who they are, Booker T. Coleman, Anthony Browder, some of the other brothers, Smalls and Dr. Leonard Jeffers, and some of our other renowned historians that we know about, who Ashraf Kwesi, who are out speaking today. We have to rethink a lot of the things that we've been putting out and have been saying, and have to go back, because there's more light shining today than yesterday. There's more knowledge out there that we have access to that Dr. Ben and Dr. Clark didn't have access to, you see, and then Amos Wilson didn't have access to. There's more knowledge out there today, so we got to rethink a lot of things. Okay, Brother George, back to you.
Yes, sir. Well, brother, you know, I just, would like you to get into the lecture today. You gave us...
You mean the second lecture today?
Yeah, the second lecture today, you know, and you know, we're gonna have question and answer. So somewhere around 3:05, we can start the question and answer, you know. But for right now, you can get into your lecture for today.
Okay, which is a review of my book, Recapturing the African Mind, and you may say, or you may think, that we haven't been talking about the book, but that's what we've really been doing, George, you and our conversation. We recapturing the African mind, aren't we?
Yes, sir.
That's exactly what we're doing. We're still on the subject, listeners, to those who are tuned in. We're on the subject now. We're recapturing the African mind. Now, today in my book, Recapturing the African Mind. I'm starting on page 52, and so those who have the book can be with me. I'm not reading directly from the book. Some things I will, but for the most part, I'm not. But this is the chapter called Missionaries as Tools in the Mind Control of African People. Missionaries as Tools in the Mind Control of African People. Last week, I talked about how the Pope issued the bull. He issued an edict, E-D-I-C-T. He issued an edict for the explorers to go around the world and to take the religion of Christianity. And when I say religion of Christianity, I'm really talking about the false religion of Christianity, because Christianity came from African people. It's our religion. We were the first to develop the ideas and the concepts and the belief system. It came from our people. But talking about these were people who were taking the Christian religion around the earth and giving it to many of the lands that they conquered from a Eurocentric perspective. Now, in my book on page 52, and to those who may have the book, I have a section here where I have in the italics, that funny kind of writing, which is the first paragraph on page 52. Among the many works pleasing to the divine magic and desirable child hearts, this particularly prevails. Now, listen very carefully. This was in the Pope's words for the sailors and explorers and missionaries to go around the world. He said, this particularly prevails that the Catholic faith and the Christian religion, especially in our times, may be exalted, amplified, and everywhere diffused. Listen again. He says that this particularly prevails that the Catholic faith and Christian religion, especially in our times, may be, listen to those words, exalted, mean held up, hold up the Christian religion now, hold up the Catholic faith, pardon me, may be exalted, amplified. You know what your amplifier is, make it loud, you know, make it scream, boom, boom, boom box. That the Catholic faith be exalted, amplified, and everywhere diffused or spread out. Spread it out everywhere, out, and hold it up high. And then the Pope says, the salvation of souls procured and barbarous nations subjected and made obedient to the faith. What was happening here, brothers and sisters, is that the Catholics were taking their religion, which they had concocted or made up, and were spreading it into nations and islands, lands and territories all around the world, and to subject the people who are already there and make them obedient to Catholicism. Now, you can read all this on your own if you have, or if you decide to get a copy of my book. But on page 53, now, the first complete paragraph again, he says, we have heard to our great joy that you have proposed labor and used every exertion. First they wanted to amplify, exalt, and diffuse, but now he says, want you to use every exertion that the inhabitants of certain islands and continents, remote and hitherto unknown, meaning take this, exert yourselves and take this religion everywhere to remote continents, to those unknown, and others, I'm back reading now, and others yet undiscovered, be induced to worship our Redeemer and press the Catholic faith. So this is what the Pope commanded the explorers and the missionaries and the merchants to do, and to take this religion of Catholicism around the world. I repeat now, it's not we get in the black church that they were taking around the world for the most part. We're getting away from that today. But this is the Christianity from the Eurocentric perspective. And just wanted to kind of go over that. And then they wanted us to spread the gospel. Not us, but Europeans were spreading the gospel. Now, and there's no doubt too that this this bull of demarcation, as it was called, the bull of demarcation, the stamp of approval, in other words, of Pope Alexander VI, on page 57 at the bottom, there's no doubt that this bull of Alexander VI is the most comprehensive and far-reaching heist, this is my word now, heist of lands and territories ever executed in the history of the world, embracing as it did the entire central and southern portions of the Western Hemisphere. This was a heist. And you know what a heist is. You've seen the heist on TV and movies when they're going to have a big heist of a bank. It means a takeover, to steal, to rob. The Pope also commended Spain and Portugal for their holy intentions of spreading the Catholic faith. All right. And then on page 58, I go into what they were spreading, the gospel. Now, let's take a look at this word gospel to those students who are here with us in class today on the African-American Empowerment program. The word gospel, I'm reading from my book, which is commonly defined as good or glad tidings, or the stories of Christ's life in the first four books of the New Testament. Now, this is the way gospel is usually defined. I'm going to read that again. Good or glad tidings are the stories of Christ's life in the first four books of the New Testament. Now, going back to my words, reading again from the book, should be examined much more thoroughly. The etymological or true or real meaning of the word, etymology, study of the origin, growth, and development of words, for those who may be taking notes, etymology. The etymological true or real, meaning of the word gospel is derived from the word G-O-D-S-P-E-L, God spell, or the spell of God. This is where the word gospel comes from. Now, these are my words, reading from my book. Spell is defined as a word which means having charming, magical powers, or the ability to bind or hold the mind through formula of fascination. Another term associated with spell is enchantment. Now, these are not my words. I'm going to read them again. But what I just said is from a book called Origins, a short etymological dictionary of modern English. Origins, a short etymological dictionary of modern English on page 259. As I said to you all earlier on this in this classroom, don't take my word for anything. If I say it, don't take my word. Check it out on your own, but you best believe that I wouldn't put it in here if I couldn't stand behind it. But Eric Partridge wrote the book called Origins. He didn't write it. Eric Partridge. The book is called Origins, a short etymological dictionary of modern English. And in that book, he said that spell is defined as a word which means having charming magical powers or the ability to bind or hold the mind through some formula of fascination. And so this is the kind of gospel that they were spreading around the world to our people and to native or indigenous people, still our people. So I wanted to make that clear. As we said before, words are very important. Now, next paragraph, reading directly from the book, page 58. Europeans during early contact with African people understood that Africans are highly spiritual. The God concept of Africans was altered through several years of influential teaching and training sessions by the missionaries. Indoctrination of the gospel, spell of God, in the mission schools, upon the minds of African children, aided in the process of mind erosion. Spellbinding, magical, enchanting tales of God were to be so successful in the process of mind devastation that armed with the quote-unquote armed with gospel and guns, Europeans usurped the richest piece of real estate on the planet. Armed with the guns, armed with the gospel, they were able to take the wealth from under the feet of the indigenous people, under the feet of African people around the world. So I want to make that point clear, and then I go into a brief discussion, which we'll do before we take of mine destruction in the Congo part of the earth in Africa. Mine destruction in the Congo. Okay, on page 59. Now, in the Congo region of Africa, Catholic priests were welcomed. This is one thing about us, brothers and sisters, and I used to hear Dr. Clark say it many times when he would lecture and speak and do workshops, seminars. He would always say that one fault about black people, we were too kind to strangers. And that's the way we are today. Somebody come to your house, oh, come on in, have a seat, relax yourself. Can I get you a drink? Can I get you some water? Can I get you some juice? Can I get you a rum and coke? Can I get you a Heineken? Can I get you a glass of milk? Can I get you something? Because I want to make you comfortable. And we welcomed strangers in, and these strangers did not have didn't have any good intentions towards us in their minds. Their intentions were to rob us. But we've always been kind to strangers, and it's not always a good idea to be kind to strangers. And as I was talking to somebody the other day, I can't remember who it was, but usually when you hear about somebody robbing somebody or robbing somebody's house or stealing something from somebody, already know by having visited that particular location, that house, that apartment, by having visited that building or whatever the case may be, or knowing the person, they already know that there's something there. When they break into your car, they're not going to break into a car for no reason at all. They know you got some CDs in there. You might have some money under the seat or whatever the case may be, but they know there's some jewelry. They know there's some valuables in your house. They may have come to your house for a party. They may have come to your house for a cookout, and then they go back later on when you're not there and prey upon you and study your habits and your ways and what you're doing, and then they're able to rob you. But they know something's there. White people knew that there was something in the Congo when they went there, and we welcomed them. Upon their arrival, back to the book now, page 59, to our students, upon their arrival, they converted many of the indigenous people to Christianity. There was an alliance established between the king of the Congo and the king of Portugal, because the Congo region was colonized by the Portuguese. After Dominican, Franciscan, and other Catholic missionaries were sent to the Congo in 1484 in large numbers, the king of the Congo and other high officials soon embraced Catholicism. They got you now. They got you now. These people embrace Catholicism. This is me talking, not from the book. But they embraced Catholicism, and it was all over then. The king's acceptance of Catholicism enabled the missionaries to begin the destruction of the minds of the Congolese. And what they began doing is, I'm going a little further, local leaders, because you have to realize now that in many cases, brothers and sisters, when things have happened to us, it was due to some of our people, our leaders, our chiefs, our heads of the tribe who were collaborating with the Europeans. Now, that's the thing. When we begin to study the history and information that I mentioned earlier that we have access to, this history and this information, it's not always good. It's not always kind. You might not want to hear it, but it is our history, and I won't go into that. That's another story. I'll get off into something else. But the local leaders assisted the priests in inducing the inhabitants to abandon their practices and beliefs in favor of the rites and ceremonies of the Catholic Church. Get rid of your African culture. Get rid of your African heritage, and then let's take on what these strangers have given us as Catholicism. That's me talking. In doing, back to the book, Africans of the Congo region gave up their own minds and accepted the European mind. The strategies employed by the Catholic priests and missionaries, the strategies were so successful that in a few years the whole nation became nominally Christian. A Jesuit college and a Capuchin monastery was built. With the building of church and university again, they built a church and a college. And what did we say before? As Bob Marley says, the Babylon system is the vampire, sucking the blood of the children day by day, building church and university, deceiving the people continually. And this is what happened here. A Jesuit college was built, and a monastery was built. That's your church, and that's your university. And with back to the reading now. With the building of church and university, the Portuguese were able to exert total control over the minds of Africans in the Congo. And when you begin to take control of a person's mind, there's no problem getting all those rich valuable resources from the earth. If I got control of your mind, I can take anything that you have. Back to the book. Portuguese became the language of the court. Dropped their own language, started speaking Portuguese. And many Congolese learned to read and write Portuguese as well as church Latin. With the building of the school, the Congolese people were encouraged by the head or the king to adopt Europe. Now, here they go. They got you speaking the language now. It's me talking. And they got the Congolese people to adopt European clothing, to adopt European dress, and European manners. So you're speaking my language now. You're dressing like me. You got my mannerisms, everything I have. In other words, the Congolese people have become Portuguese. This is what's going on, brothers and sisters. Now let's go on. Back to the book, page 60. The capital was renamed São Salvador, which is a Portuguese name. That's the capital now, São Salvador. Portuguese, change the name. Now, I just want you to think for me. That's why I'm hesitating. Just want you to think. Change the name of the capital city. Now, the king at the time was a man, back to the book, whose name was Nzinga Maimba. But he took the Portuguese name of Dom Alfonso. Reading on. Erasing his African name and replacing it with a colonial name was another step toward the destruction of his African mind. Further, the king of the Congo made certain that his sons were miseducated in Portugal. This miseducation of the future leadership of the Congo guaranteed the perpetuation of the European mentality in the Congo for years to come. So the king had his sons become Portuguese by changing name, changing the clothes, and then send them off to Portugal to study, you see. So this is okay. Now, just to give you an idea of what happened in Portugal, that's just a little information I have there on Portugal, and then I'm going to talk about Angola for a minute, and then we're going to go to back to Brother George. But as I said before, we're talking about the Congo and Angola, and Angola, of course, as you know, is further down to the southern part of Africa. In the Angolan schools, the religious emphasis was evident. There were daily periods in Bible and religious history. There were prayers before and after meals, after work, before bed, and in the mornings. Now, this is me talking. This was a book I was reading, but I want to just say this. So you see how they were infusing our minds tremendously with their perspective of Christianity. There were prayers before and after meals, after work, before bed, and in the mornings. Back to the book. Religion was a major part of the daily schedule and was always at the forefront of school activities. And there's nothing wrong with this if it's going to be a religion that's going to speak to you and your people and your problems and to come from your perspective and your way of thinking. But that's not what that religion was doing. back to the book again. This should not be surprising, and going back again, saying that religion was at the forefront. This should not be surprising since Catholic priests were being trained before each class. The students had to were being trained. They were training Catholic priests. In other words, they were training the children in Angolan schools to become Catholic priests. Back to the book. Before each class, the students had to pray. Prayer was also conducted at the conclusion of each class. Every time a new teacher entered the classroom, the students stood and prayed. The students were told that they should follow the same procedure when they became priests. Now, this is me talking. So what you have happening here is that once the people were taught, then they're supposed to teach the same thing again. So you have white people teaching black people to become Catholic priests, but then once those black Catholic priests become priests, they go back among their own people and teach the same thing that's been taught to them. When, and this is me talking, I'm not in the book. When you and I, brothers and sisters, go and matriculate at these Caucasian universities or these black universities that that teach from a white perspective, we should not take that same material and go back and poison our people, but that's what most of us do. And most times we don't know it, but this is why we have to study and learn and begin to unlearn some of the things that we've been taught and begin to give it out. You know, we got to shoot, got to come back with some other way of giving the information out, because what good would it do us as a people to continuously miseducate our people like we have been miseducated? What good would it do for people like me and people who have gone to school and have studied and learned, but to give back the same miseducation that I received? No, I've learned some different things now, so that means my teaching should be different. What I teach should be different. Back to the book. Supplement this religious tone was a national emphasis on religious practices. For example, if the history teacher was French, French religion and history were stressed. If the teacher was Belgian, which was the case many times, then the emphasis would be placed on Belgian history and religious institutions. I'm reading from my book, brothers and sisters. I'm still reading, still in the book. No African history was taught. I want to go back over that for a minute. If the history teacher was French, then she or he would stress French religion and French history. If the teacher was from Belgium, then that particular teacher would emphasize Belgian history and Belgian religious institutions. Now, back reading again. No African history was taught. Still reading. The curriculum in the Portuguese colony of Angola was similar to the courses of study at comparable seminaries in France and the United States. The most prominent studies were those of religion and philosophy. A strong emphasis was placed on Latin and Greek. History that was taught held Portugal and her colonies in Africa as a major focus. Listen to me now, brothers and sisters. I'm reading from my book, Recapturing the African Mind. Less emphasis was placed on math and world history since the studies were geared to training priests. The classroom training that took place among Africans in the Portuguese missionary schools was to be passed on to other Africans that they would later instruct. And this is from a book called African Reactions to Missionary Education, page 54 through 74. And Brother George, that's a good stopping point, because next week after next, when I come back on, I'm going to go into mine destruction in Burkina Faso, which is in West Africa. I was down in Central and South Africa, but I'm going to West Africa and talk about Burkina Faso. And then the following week, next week we should get to this too. I'm going to talk about mine destruction in Nigeria and Sierra Leone. You see, so we getting very geographic here. We're traveling around. You know, we've been down to Puerto Rico and got Dr. Schomburg, went on back up to New York and Harlem with the brothers on the 125th and Lenox up there in New York. We hit down in down in Angola and down in the Congo. So I'm going to give it back to you, and we can open up.
Okay, brother. Well, man, that was a great two lectures in one day. And I really want to thank you for that, you know. But right now, I'm going to go over to Sister Jackie, and she's going to handle the question and answer. Are you there,
okay,
Sister Jackie?
Yes, I'm here.
Yes.
Thank you, Brother George. And thank you, Dr. Bridges. I did have a question. I know you're going through the book, but you mentioned earlier something about how many secrets the Vatican has and some other places that like to keep our history away from us. Excuse me. But I am really interested in hearing about the secret societies that they have out here and how they have affected the African Americans or Black people all over the world. How these secret societies have really affected us or have held us back? Because we're always hearing about stuff about the Illuminati and stuff like that, but these are just things that, you know, people speculate about, but I am really interested in hearing that information. But again, I know you're going, you know, going according to your book, but I would really love to hear about that.
And you know that, and you said it absolutely, and you're absolutely correct in your statement. That is another lecture within itself. And what I'd like to do, Brother George, if you don't mind, and we can talk about it a little later. I have a good brother. I don't know if he's tuned in today or not, but you know him, Brother George, Brother Fahim Knight. And he has about three, I think maybe about three books that he's coming out with on the Illuminati. And maybe if Sister can hold on, I could go into it too, but if Sister can hold on to week after next and we can have him on before I come on to answer that question. And I'll get in touch with him and see if we can do that next week, and he can talk about his books. And then, you know, just a few minutes to answer a question before I get on with my part of the lecture. That's okay.
Oh, that would be great. I would love to hear that. And I'm
okay,
sure Marvin, speaking for Marvin, but I'm sure he would have that too.
Oh, yeah.
Okay.
While Brother George is going to another caller, I have my other phone, and I'm going to text Brother Fahim right now that I just mentioned his name in case he's not listening. I did text for him to listen. And then see if he can do that next week.
Okay, so what we're going to do is we're going to go to the phone lines, and what I'm going to do
week.
Is I'm going to call.
I meant week after next, not next week. Week
after next
when I'm back on. Okay.
Mm-hmm. Okay. What I'm going to do is I'm going to call the last four digits of your phone number, and if you want to speak, we'd love to hear from you. So I'm going to go to the first caller, and I'm not going to do the same thing as Marvin. I'm not going to put an intro on for you. So I'm just going to call you and let you go ahead and ask your questions. So I am reaching out to the last four digits is 1688. If you want to talk to us, let us know. 1688, you're live.
Yeah, okay. How you doing, Brother Bruce? This is Brother Barry from New York. Hello?
Okay, Brother Barry. Come on, brother.
Yeah, when you were talking about Harlem, there was a gentleman by the name of Carlos Cook that was up there in Harlem. And very very information on him. I was wondering if you could touch on Carlos Cook's role in the African panacea in Harlem.
Okay, I was calling you, but okay, bro, did you say Carlos Cook?
Yeah, Brother Bruce. Is back.
Okay. Yeah, brother. I just caught your voice. Yeah. Just briefly. Carlos Cook, I think, was basically from and brother Barry. Matter of fact, since you asked that question and you kind of know, go ahead and tell the people a little bit about Carlos Cook, and I'm going to come in because I know you know about him. You want the people to know, right?
Yeah.
Well, go ahead. Just tell them about Carlos Cook, and then I'll come back in on him because I got information on him too. By you being a New Yorker too and having access to that Schomburg, and I know you asked that question for the people because you know. So go ahead, tell them about Carlos Cook, because and before you talk about him, he also was kind of contemporaries with Marcus Garvey, who I didn't talk about, who was very important in the Harlem Renaissance. Go ahead, Brother Barry.
Yeah, Carlos Cook, he was born in the Dominican Republic, and he had kept the Garvey movement going. He didn't like a lot of publicity or not. I know Malcolm X even went to him one day, and he said, Mr. Cook, what do you mean you're going to have dialogue? And Carlos Cook said, when you get an agenda, we'll talk. You know, and he used to actually go to these places where they were exploiting black women and fight the mafia and everybody.
That's right.
Didn't make him any difference. You know. Yeah, but he's very, very little on him, but he preferred it that way, I guess, because you know.
And it's good you brought him up too, brother Bear, because most people don't know about Carlos Cook. They know Marcus Garvey, but they don't know about Carlos Cook. And you know, and since we're talking about it too, Carlos Cook, like Marcus Garvey, studied too under the Egyptian historian who had that newspaper over in London called the Orient Review, I think it was called. Deuce Muhammad Ali, that's his name. Deuce Muhammad Ali.
Right.
Exactly. So, like I said, I did know about Carlos Cook, but I want you to bring out some. But yeah, they studied under Deuce Muhammad Ali, and his name is probably less well known than is Carlos Cook. But Marcus Garvey said that's how he was inspired by the work of Deuce Muhammad Ali. And to tie this back into the Harlem Renaissance, Garvey was inspired by Deuce Muhammad Ali, as many of the people in the Harlem Renaissance were inspired by Arthur Schomburg and his collection. But there were still forces that caused them to want to become more black-oriented and black-conscious. I mentioned the race riots in East St. Louis of 1917 and the lynchings in America. But Marcus Garvey was inspired by Deuce Muhammad Ali, but he also saw racism when he left Jamaica before coming to the United States and went to Panama and saw our people working for little or nothing building the Panama Canal, you see. So after mistreatment by white people in the world, after mistreatment by them and having this ill feelings toward our conquerors and our colonizers, once that happens, and then we begin to get something to feed on, like the Harlem Renaissance, or for black people in Harlem, and Schomburg, or like Deuce Muhammad Ali in his Orient Review, like Garvey, then we can go into action. We've been mistreated already. And then if you give us some ammunition, give us some history, give us some knowledge, give us something that will inspire us to do something about it, in the same way that Aimé Césaire, Leopold Senghor, and Léon Dumas saw mistreatment of black people in French-speaking islands like Haiti, like Guadeloupe, and like you know, Martinique, then they began to study the Harlem Renaissance. So one movement begins to spur on another, is the point I wanted to make. So Carlos Cook definitely is important. Brother, thanks for calling. I hope you got something from today's lecture.
I want to make this last statement, though. And the FBI, Gay Edgar Hoover, he said that if you let Garvey and Deuce Muhammad Ali get together, we won't be able to stop them. So do not let this man meet with Garvey.
Deuce Muhammad Ali?
Deuce Muhammad Ali, yes.
Okay. And since you mentioned too, which we won't go into right now, Brother Barry, and I know you probably know about this, there's a sister, a black woman from Mississippi, who wrote a book about J. Edgar Hoover's black blood and living in the black community up there in Washington, D.C. His parents were when they first went there from down in Mississippi, that he tried to deny J. Edgar Hoover. See, but they keep, that's another thing they keep covered.
Yes.
J. Edgar Hoover.
Yes.
All right, thank you very much, Brother Byron.
Oh, my pleasure, man, always. Bruce, you're a master teacher, too.
Thank you. All right, so I'm going to go ahead to the next caller, 3347. 3347. Would you like to talk to us? Are you there?
Some people don't want to say anything, huh? They don't want to
say
anything. Okay.
Going once, going twice. All right, we're going to our next caller. And this is a Richmond number, 0673. Are you talking to us?
My brother Cavalon from Gable Prosser City. People call Richmond. We changed the name, though. Bruce, to support all this effort, all this you've been going through to open our minds, it's one of my favorite passages in the Bible, because you mentioned weeks ago that there's some truth in these myths. And Matthew chapter 13, verse 10 to 17. Matthew chapter 13, verse 10 to 17. My favorite scripture, right? Disciples asked Jesus, and why do you speak parable to the people? He said, the secret to the kingdom of heaven is not for them, it's for you. And the disciples said, why not for them? He said, because they got ears, but hear not, eyes, and see not. So the secret to the kingdom of heaven is not for them, it's for you. So people on this program, they have ears, they hear. They have eyes, and they see. And the reason a lot of people are not welcoming, you know, more people like Bruce and others, right, is because their ears are stuffed up. And the eyes won't allow them to see. So I just make that point is there's some truth in scripture when you read it. Now one thing I'm bringing about is the Congo. I was at work one day reading a book, and I was reading the books at work, right? Guess what you guys said? Read the history book. He saw Mark Twain. But the book says Mark Twain. All he knew was Huckleberry Finn and Tom Sawyer. He didn't know about how Mark Twain attacked the missionaries in all his writings, right? So I saw my pastor called King Leopold Soliloquy. And I'm going to do what Bruce did. I'm going to spell it for the listeners. King Leopold. Leopold spelled L-E-O-P-O-L-D apostrophe S. Soliloquy means speaking to yourself. S-O-L-I-L-O-Q-U-I. S-O-L-I-L-O-Q-U-Y. King Leopold Soliloquy. And I first got my book from Steve Coakley. But since then, I got the actual book, 1905. He talks about the Belgian Congo, and King Leopold says, y'all say I got a pirate flag over here, United States, y'all saluting it. You say I'm cutting Africa's arms, right? Y'all financing it. So all that was in Mark Twain's book. But a lot of times you go to these bookstores, you try to find it, they can't find it. And I went to a bookstore, the guy said, I never heard of that book before. I got all Mark Twain's titles. He couldn't find that book, but he found a compilation. Of all of Mark Twain's title, and the back of the book, he saw King Leopold's Soliloquy. He said, what that book is about? I said, read that book. If you ever get a copy, read that book, and you'll find out why you won't find that book in a lot of these bookstores. But you go online and look up now, it's called King Leopold's Soliloquy, and I was fortunate enough to get a copy, original copy, the first print in 1905. So if you want to know about the Belgian Congo, you didn't go in depth with the Belgian Congo, but that's a good book that talks about the Belgian Congo.
Thanks, brother.
And I'll let them ask, make a comment.
Thank you, Kevin Lang.
Thank you. All right, we're going to go to our next call. Did you want to say something?
No, ma'am.
Moved on? Okay.
Yes.
Going to our next caller, 8502. 8502. All right, let me see if I can get you in. Sorry about that. 8502.
Yes, good afternoon.
Good afternoon.
I'd just like to make a comment on how important this information that Brother Bruce has given us today. When African people were on the plantation, the most serious violation that you could commit was learning how to read. So if a group of us like we are today was sitting around listening to what Brother Bruce is telling us, we'd all be severely whipped and maybe killed.
Mm.
That's a good point. You're absolutely right, Carla. We would definitely be, that's right, especially this kind of information that I'm giving out today and will be giving out within the next few weeks. You're right, absolutely. Slave masters never wanted us to have information, and what they've done nowadays, as I said, as I keep reiterating, they've given us what we think is information. They've given us what we think is knowledge, and they put a piece of paper behind it and call it a degree, and we think we have something, and that's also very deceptive. So this call, absolutely right, sister and Brother George, absolutely right. Okay.
All right, thank you. I am going to our next caller. The last four digits is 0148. 0148. Are you talking to us today?
Yes, good afternoon.
Good afternoon.
Thank you for taking my call, Sister Jackie, and good evening, Brother George. And it's always a pleasure to hear you, Dr. Bridges. It's always a pleasure. I want to go back to a character you had mentioned in your book, most specifically, Don M. Fonzo, or King Nzinga. And with him being a king at the time he was and had that experience with the Portuguese, how could he have bent himself to adopt Catholicism? If I guess in my mind, he's a king. He is the leader of people. What specifically could he have lost out on to become Catholic? And for him and his family and those people in that part of the world to bend themselves to Catholicism. And I'm also really kind of leaning toward his character as a leader of people at that time. Did any of your work, your research, lean towards his character or his leadership ability?
Yeah, not too much, but what I, brother, is that these Catholic missionaries and priests were so adept, so good at what they were doing, and spreading the word and knowing, as I read earlier today, about African spirituality. You see, when people know that there's something when people know you, and this is another thing too, which I get to later in the book, European people, even before this, had studied us, studied our ways and habits, and really did a lot of reconnaissance on us, and they understood, and even today still understand, that we are basically a spiritual people. We are a spiritual people. And so when people know, and I'm not calling being spiritual a weakness, but if they know that they can exploit that and make it a weakness, then to get what they want, then that's what they do. And that's what I think happened they exploited our spiritual nature and our closeness to the cosmos and our closeness to each other and our brotherhood. And like I said, we were very kind to strangers. When people see that, they can exploit that and get what they want and make you to believe what they want. Now, another point I want to make is that in many cases, African people did not accept Christianity because they believed in it. And when I say Christianity, I'm talking about this European stuff. I'm not talking about black folks' Christianity. But they will do it for political purposes, and that's definitely true in the case of Islam. When Islam went into North Africa, the kings and rulers accepted Islam because for political purposes, it would get them further in the world, and they could have more to gain by accepting it than not accepting it. So there are reasons that people do things, but in the Congo, I think that, because they get favors. They get favors from accepting certain kinds of things. Now, on the side or at night when Europeans are not around, anybody who's been to Africa and seeing Africans and their religion, they may accept this European Christianity on the surface. And a good example is Haiti. But at the same time, they had the belief in their own gods and their own goddesses and their own rituals, and they practiced them out in the backyard where nobody can see it. For example, the Christianity that was being practiced on the plantations in America by Absalom Jones and by Richard Allen was not the kind of Christianity that you would see black people practicing when the slave master was around. That's why it was called the invisible institution. You go back away from the master under a tree in the woods and you are having church, but the master thinks you're having the kind of church that he wants you to have, but you're plotting and planning and trying to get off that plantation. And that's the way African people have done it in the past, and even today during the 60s movement, many of the meetings, as you well know, organizing meetings and meetings, planning meetings, were held in black churches, you see. So that's the way we have to look at it, though. And I hope that kind of answers your question.
Thank you. And just as a follow-up, you mentioned about the newspaper out of the UK, Look and Listen. I usually, from time to time, visit the Gleamer, the Jamaican Gleamer out of the Caribbean area. And so to try to show my black history was kind of looking into other areas of the world where people have populated. And so what does it mean to be an Afro-Caribbean or Afro-Costa Rican, Afro-Brazilian, et cetera, et cetera? So I was just kind of wanted you to kind of mention more, just a little bit more as much as you could about the Look and Listen out of the UK. And could we actually study those kinds and types of literatures or readings? Is there anything wrong?
Yeah, we can't. As a matter of fact, I think it's under the website archives.org. I think that's it. That's the one where I got that information. But I think it's called Look and Learn. I think it's Learn, I believe. It was issue number 1004. It came out in 1981, and there's a website called archives.org. And you can find this information, and see that's what I'm saying. This information, man, it's out there, but it's been kept away from us. And I go back again to the example. You know, let's buy this Schomburg materials up, and they Europeans will pay for a collection or for books and manuscripts. Pay just to get them off the market, like I said, just so that we won't have access, and that's what has happened to a lot of our material.
Asante Sana, brother. Thank you.
Yeah, thank you for calling, too, brother.
All right, I just wanted to let you all know that we only have about 7 minutes left, so I do want to try to get to another caller. Thank you, 0148. Dr. Bridges, you okay with going to another caller?
Yeah, I'm here. Just let me keep it brief. Keep it brief because we have to deal with it.
Okay. Yeah, because we're down to about six minutes. So call us 6511. 6511. All right. Would you like to talk to us?
Yes, I'm just listening, recording everything they say. Next time we'll come in, you know. I'm just listening and recording. Yeah.
Thank you so much.
Good.
Really good show. Yeah.
All right. I'm going over to caller 9619.
Hey, that's me. Thank you so much for taking my call. I know you said be brief, and that's going to be a challenge for me.
Thank you, Dr. Bridges, for being there. Oh, wow.
Okay. Well, let me get into it. Thank you so much, Dr. Bridges, for being there. I wanted to say amen, but I didn't know if that would be part of that religious indoctrination that I got, and that mental gentrification that you were talking about. But the religion was a major component. We can stop going to a religious service that's going to be detrimental to us, but we are still part of this colonial language. And now that they have introduced television and social media, how will that exacerbate the problems that we're dealing with? And thank you for being a guide or a compass to show us how to navigate through this cesspool of albinism. And because you
now, where are you calling from, caller? Where are you calling from?
Seattle, Washington.
Okay, 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 good.
Yeah, Seattle, Washington. You were just out here a couple of weeks ago. And
okay,
you mentioned that
and I asked because we always like to hear from our callers and where they're from, so we're gaining some listeners. We're all out in the West Coast now. That's good. But to answer your question, because our time is about out, yes, the television has not helped us at all in terms of us getting our minds back. As a matter of fact, which is another lecture, when you see movies like Braveheart and some of those other movies that are based in Scotland and Ireland, they have characters who are white. Originally, those characters were people in black skin, but that's been being covered. That's just an example I'm giving. What's the other movie with the cartoon? Esmeralda, you see, they have her a little dark in this Walt Disney thing, you see, but she's supposed to be a gypsy, and gypsy from the word gypsy, Egypt. But anyway, that's another lecture. To answer your question, yes, it's detrimental. Television is detrimental to us when we don't know what we're doing. But now, if you look at it with a critical eye, and study movies with a critical eye, you can get a lot of information. As an example, when you look at some of the old Western movies like Jim Bowie or Yancey Derringer, and I'm going way back, they talk about the slave plantations of Louisiana, the slave plantations down in the southern part of this country, but you wouldn't know it unless you're looking at it with a critical eye. That's just giving you an example of how you can look at it critically, you see. But if you know, or when you watch Sherlock Holmes talks about European colonialism around the world all the time that was taking place during the age of Queen Victoria. They talk about Trinidad and they talk about Egypt in some of those programs. But if you don't have a critical eye and a historical background, it will go right over your head. Back to you, sister. Thank you very much for your call, brother.
You're more than welcome. And do that deprogramming thing too, because the television is programming. So how do we deprogram?
Okay.
Brother Bruce.
Back to the sister. Okay.
You have to, I don't mean to cut you off, brother. You can ask that question the next time Bruce comes back. Tell them the next time that you'll be back, brother, and we can allow Sister Jackie to close out. You got about a minute.
Right.
Bruce. Dr. Bridges.
Next week, this is a good program just to keep clocked into your telephone or your computer every Saturday at 2 o'clock. But I will be back week after next week. But the program is a good program to listen to at any time. And I'll be going into Burkina Faso, the second part of my book. And anybody who has questions, they can hold those questions to next week, and we'll try to get to them. And by the way, Sister Jackie, I intend to try to have the brother on to answer the question that you asked this week. So week after next, see you then. But to be on point, just tune in every Saturday at 2 o'clock Eastern Standard Time for the African American Empowerment.
Thank you, Dr. Bridges, and I apologize. I muted your line by mistake. So if you don't, I don't know how much we missed, but I did hear that you will
be
here. Oh,
man, I didn't know. So,
after next. I'm sorry. But, no, you said you'll be here week after next, which is March 19th. And, so we heard most of it, but I apologize for that.
Glad you gave the date, too, right? March 19th, I'll be back again. But be sure to listen to this program, brothers and sisters, those who are tuned in, every Saturday at 2 o'clock p.m. When it comes on. But I will be back on March 19th. But just to stay on point, just tune in every Saturday at 2 o'clock p.m. with Brother Marvin and Brother George and Sister Jackie on the African American Empowerment Program.
Yes. Thank you so much, Dr. Bridges. Thank you, Brother George. I really appreciate it. And in Marvin's absence, I thank everyone for today. Next week.
Was he listening to wherever he is?
Everybody have a good afternoon. I'm sorry, Brother George?
No. Mm-mm.
Thank you so much. Everybody have a great weekend.